Accession number 8171, Reel 12.
Mr. Metalman, Reel 12. You were saying about the starving Russian women, about how many of them attempted to get into the store?
Well, it happened at different times. We stayed in Bukovskaya for several days, I think, 2-3 days, and continuously there was some trouble, always 2-3, sometimes up to 10 or 12. And they were chased away by the guards and just run around to the other side, to the other entrance to the store. It was a huge store, but no doors in it. Somehow the doors had been taken out or what. And it struck me then that hungry women who try to get food for their families, for their children, that they can be a power. Normally, especially we as German soldiers, we considered the man, the Russian man, as our enemy because we were fighting him and we respected him in so many ways because he was a very tough man, a very tough soldier, conditioned by the hard circumstances of life in Russia, in the Russian countryside, historically up to then and possibly still now. Women we always considered as some secondary force, but that was for the first time really in my life that I realized women, they can be a very tough lot, and if they are determined they can achieve quite a bit, because I realized there they filled their little bags full of wheat and just walked away with it, and if the guards were not prepared to shoot them, they couldn't do anything about it, or not very much about it.
Was there any verbal contact between the guards and the women?
Yes. Well, the guards, in most cases, spoke some sort of a pidgin Russian. I spoke fairly good Russian because I was young and I was keen to learn. I spoke perhaps a little bit better Russian than most of the others. But yes, there was verbal contact, and the women just were saying they needed food, and that is their food, they were saying, that was their harvest, and they had helped to bring it in. And they have a right to. They anyway would have had a right to, they said, because that was their harvest. And the plan was always that they should have some of that wheat, and now they wanted it.
What was the wheat being stored for?
Well, in Russia at that time, and still the same, the state farms called the kolkhozen, the large community farms. Now it was winter, of course, one couldn't see the actual fields, but there were huge fields, snow covered now. And we also saw in Bukovskaya and in other places machinery, huge harvesters, for instance, as big as never I had never seen before at that time, because they had these large fields. And this was the wheat, I assume, which they harvested outside Bukovskaya, and that was had been brought into these depots, these stores. And I assume that that's what the women wanted. That was theirs, they considered it to be.
But what was the German army going to use it for?
Well, of course, I don't know. I only was there as a passing soldier, but I can imagine that the German army wanted to, they waited for some sort of transport opportunity and would have transported it away for German use, take it away from the Russian. That was general policy all along the line. The German command and the German authorities didn't really care whether the Russians starved to death or not. On the contrary, I can imagine there was a plan to get rid of as many Russians as possible, because we had our ideas to settle that area of Russia that was on the Ukraine-Russian border as so many lands in the east with German settlers, and the less Russians there were, the better, I suppose, it was for us. I'm not expressing my own view now, but I had those views in those times too.
Did any was there any actual practical move to move settlers in during the war?
No, not in that area, obviously not, because now we just had gone to reach Stalingrad and now we were on the retreat to Stalingrad. That would have been foolish to get settlers in there. But I know further back in Poland and in Bielorussia, White Russia, that some farms, I never have seen one really, but we got some sort of a Wehrmacht newspaper sometimes, and there were reports of settlers having been brought in there. If somebody got a Ritterkreuz, for instance, one of the highest German medals, sometimes it was connected with that person being given a farm. I remember one Hitler Youth leader, I forgot his name now, who lost his leg in some battle. He got a farm in Poland, and I saw something like that on some sort of newsreels. Because sometimes, in quieter times, some German film unit came out, and in some Russian peasant hut, they set it up, and we saw some films and also newsreels. I know it from there, but personal experiences with German settlers, I did not have.
What happened next?
Well, the whole situation was in a flux. We were on a retreat, but not all that hard-pressed by the Russians, because at that time they were engaged with the battle inside Stalingrad. I think Paulus surrendered at the end of January, or was it the first day of February 1943? I'm not quite sure about that. And all this happened during that time, either shortly before Paulus surrendered or shortly afterwards, and surely the Russians had to regroup. So the pressure on us was not all that bad at that time. But there was tension in the air, we were nervous. There were quite a number of skirmishes, and we tried to hold a certain line or create a certain line. I don't know really. I was no member of the high command, and it was is a long time ago. But this was generally the case after when we were defeated, and from then on, I experienced it several times that we always tried to establish HKL, main battle line. And all what we were doing now, I think we were trying to establish a firm line against further Russian advances. We knew they sooner or later would be coming, of course, after they finished Stalingrad. We expected that. And we realized that our army, our 6th Army, was in the doldrums, that there hardly would be anything for them to be saved.
Did you still feel confident about beating the Russians at this time?
No. Our confidence was severely shaken. Obviously, you lose a battle, your confidence is shaken, but also our whole upbringing, as connected now with the reality as we found it, I think has something to do with it, because we were being told that the German Wehrmacht is the greatest fighting force in the world, the German soldier is the greatest soldier that exists. And we honestly believed it, and that we had been beaten now by what we had been told were not only second-class, but third-class human beings. It shook us. We also realized in so many ways that what we thought our leadership had let us down. When you are a soldier, you see so many things. You receive orders or so, and you realize those orders are daft. After all, we were soldiers now of considerable experience, even if relatively young, as in my case, I only was then about 20. But I had experience, and very often we criticized amongst ourselves certain actions that we had to take a town or a village, and the way the orders had been given, the way we were going to do it. So confidence in our leadership, right from the top to further down, developed amongst us. We criticized it severely. There were quite a few who criticized Hitler's involvement. It was being said that he personally involved himself in little decision-making, that he moves battalions and regiments, that he goes as low as that. And we felt somebody sitting further back should not do that. And we thought that had something to do with our situation we found ourselves in. Also, local leadership. We had officers. Most of our senior officers, they belong to the aristocratic class. They have the VON in front of their names, V-O-N. That means you are a member of the aristocracy. Many of those behaved very arrogantly. And after we had been beaten, now our whole attitude to them changed. We did not look up to them anymore as at first we had done. So there was a drop in confidence.
What happened next?
Well, we moved around quite a bit. As I said, I don't know for sure whether in order to establish the HKL, the main battle line, or what other reasons there were, but we moved around. Wherever there was some report of some sort of resistant or Russian build-up, we tried to smash it, of course. And we were a panzer division. At that time, I was in the 22nd Panzer Division, and I myself was in a panzer fighting unit because I had lost my panzer. So we moved around from village to village, and we still belonged to Kampfgruppen. And I remember a little unit like ours. We had a anti-tank gun. I think it was a 7.5. I'm not sure about that. And we had our machine that pulled it, our Zugmaschine, half-truck vehicle. And we were a little unit which was very valuable to many commanders. And I remember once we were on our own, we had got an order to go to the next village. I was driving the vehicle and my five mates were sitting at the back. And a jeep came through the snow, and there was a general, a German general in that jeep at the back. And he came out and he asked us where we were going, and we were saying to so-and-so village. And he said, follow me. And we said, well, we got orders from our Kampfgruppen leader. I think it's that time it still was Captain Checker. I'm not very sure about that anymore. Anyway, we couldn't do anything about it. He just cut us short and follow me, and that's an order. And we went in quite a different direction and went into a little town. And he was very friendly with us. He was a man of about 53 years. I knew his name. I forgot it now. He was an infantry commander, the commander of a division or whatever. And he had his Gefechtsstand, his command post, in this village, or was it a little town or a large village? And right opposite us, opposite his place, there was a house with a cellar. And he put us in there, into the cellar. We left our gun outside, and it was fairly warm in the cellar because it was very cold weather. We didn't really mind, but then we realized we were under guard, because there was always a guard around, and as soon as one of us moved away or so, we were being asked where we are going, and we got food. Everything was all right. But this commander, obviously, this general, he considered us a very valuable addition to his infantry unit, because an infantry unit who has an anti-tank gun is has quite a force there, because infantry is always frightened of tanks, and if infantry can't do anything about Russian tanks, it's very bad for them. And I think he just cut all the normal rules and just kept us there. And in fact, not so long afterwards, that village was attacked by some Russian stray units, because they were obviously moving around the same as we and didn't quite know whether they were coming or going. And we were in action, and they had a tank, one tank only, and infantry, and we knocked that tank out. So this was generally a wild time, disorganized. Everyone was nervous. Nobody knew really what was going on.
Can you describe that action in which you knocked out the tank?
Yes, thinking back 40 years. It was a low part of the village. There was a little river or town. And a report had come that there were Russian units not far away and moving towards that village, where they had come from, of course, we don't know. And the general, he sent some sort of an officer across, and just we got orders to go to this lower part of the village by the river. It was frozen, of course, the river, and there was a little bridge across. And to go into a position there, because they considered most probably it was the most likely place from where the Russians would come and attack. And, of course, that happened. We heard it already. We heard the tank approaching, and we were in good position. We were down by the river, and there were some willow trees. We had knocked off some bushes, and nobody could see our gun, really, from the other side of the river. And then we heard the voices, the Russians shouting, and the tank. And they were sitting on the tank, quite a few, and some of them were walking behind it, and there were some jeeps and some lorries as well, because to them it must have been a very dicey situation too. They were approaching our village, whether they knew it was occupied by the Germans or not, of course, I don't know. But we let this tank come and came very close to the river, and still on the other side, something like 150 yards away, and we opened fire and hit it quickly. It blew up, and we most probably killed all the infantry sitting on them. They were surprised. It was a surprise attack. They hadn't seen us down there. And well, from then on, the Russians ran. They went back because they only had that tank. And from then on, we were the celebrated friends of that infantry division. I know one laughs about it now, one shouldn't. But these were the facts of life as we met them in those days.
Was that a T-34?
No. No, I don't know. Can't remember now. It was less than a T-34. It was a smaller, an old-fashioned tank. I remember we said we couldn't be very proud of knocking a thing out like that, because there is no great difficulty to knock a thing out. But exactly what it was, it's too long ago. I can't remember.
What happened next?
Well, so many things happened. We were now moving back, I think, and moved towards a larger town where the railway still was running to, called Morozovskaya. We went into that town, and it was considered that we should hold the line, or that the railway line should be protected, because we now notice that trains were still coming into Morozovskaya from the west, ammunition trains, food trains, and to hold a place like that is very important. Before we came to the place, there was another little spy incident. These spy incidents, they are funny. One doesn't really know, when one is in a strange country, whom to trust and whom not to trust. Of course, the best thing is not to trust anyone under those conditions. But we were in a village, and as we always did, we moved into some sort of a house and said, well, the peasant cottage and said, well, here we are, and that's it, and we are staying here. And if they had two rooms, we threw them out of one, or just told them to get out of one, and we took the best room and left the other room to them. So we stayed with the family there, and they were very nice. And there was a, later on, we thought about it, that we had been fools. A middle-aged couple and some children and an old couple, parents, I suppose, of either the man or the wife. But the man, he was in his best age, somewhere like 35 or so. He was a very resourceful man and an intelligent man, and we never questioned it, what he was doing there, because normally when we went into the villages, men of the fighting age we never found. It was only women or old people or children. And he was very friendly with us, and told his wife to make some food for us, which she did, and we were quite happy. We were five of us, and we slept now in his house, and we ate there. We had our own food, but the woman was a very good cook, and we ate really together with that family, and it was all very nice. And there were some skirmishes. Russians were reported to approach that villages, that village, and we moved out to had a little battle with them. We drove them back, and then we came back to the village, I think, the next day again. And we were being told by an officer, everything was confused in those days, whether we had seen a man of about 35 or what in that village. And we said, yes, we even knew his name. We called him Ivan. And, he said, we are after him. Now, you go back to that place and get him. We want him alive. And we went back to the place and moved in again. Hello, here we are. And there was his wife, and they were rather subdued, I remember. And one of us asked, and where's Ivan then? And she said, oh, he isn't here. He isn't here. He said something about having to go to the other village or so. And I could see she was close to crying, and I said to her, what's the matter? And she said, is it true that they are after Ivan? And one must understand, I think, at that time, we were very dissatisfied with our leadership. We didn't trust our own officers. We were angry about them. We considered they had led us into a trap and that they had lied to us and all that. And there was some sympathy for the Russians. A general warmish sympathy was building up all along amongst us ordinary soldiers, because we realized they were tough. We respected that. And generally in the villages, we got on with the ordinary people. And I don't know whether I would ever do it again, but I said to the woman, yes, they are after you, Ivan. What has he done? And she cried, and she said, thank you. I realized afterwards, and I didn't tell anyone else, I realized that, we wouldn't catch Ivan, because she surely would make sure. And I realized that evening she disappeared. She went away. Most probably she contacted Ivan somewhere. And now I'm quite happy that I possibly saved Ivan's life. Because we were then being told that Ivan was actually a commanding officer of one of the commanding officers of the units coming towards us. And in the first place he had been caught in the village by us. He was in civilian clothes, in ordinary working clothes. And, Ivan never turned up. His wife told him. And just one little incident.
Did you tell her, give her that information when you were by yourself, or were there other
comrades? No, when I was by myself. I think so. She asked, and I mean, I didn't give her information as such. I just answered her question. Because she said, something, is it true that they are after Ivan? And Ivan had been good to us. I liked Ivan. I liked his wife. She had given us
made us good food, and I could see they were kind people, they were nice people, and somehow I wouldn't have liked it that they caught Ivan, whoever he was. So that was it. When we spoiled our own plan, I suppose, or I did. But even so, if my mates would have heard that, they wouldn't have minded, because we all were of the same kind. We were developing in the same way. We were getting fed up with the whole situation, and we realized that in so many ways we had been lied to about the Russians.
What type of lies do you have in mind?
Well, it goes back a long way, of course. The main lie was, in my view, that through the whole years before the war, except the short time when Hitler and Stalin made their pact, the story was that the Russians were massing on the other side of the border, and they were going to invade Germany, the bulwark against Bolshevism, and then they were going to take Europe. That story was general, and it was, I think, the main supporting story for the big German rearmament, for setting up all our military aims. That was the main thing. We called it the Russische Dampfwalze. The story was being spread around that they had such a powerful army, and there were so many millions of them, that they just would invade Germany and Europe. And I was not in amongst the troops which moved in under Barbarossa at the beginning of the Russian campaign, but only later. But I talked to many who moved in the very beginning, and it was a general story, a generally accepted thing, that all this has been a lie. The Russians had not massed in order to attack, because every German soldier realized that they were not really properly prepared to defend their country. And if one follows the whole history of the war, of the campaign against Russia, in the first few months we moved in like a knife into butter on a summer's day. And apart from that, to be told always they are untermenschen, the Russians, that they were third-rate people. If one is for several years in a country, and at that time I think I had been for more than a year in that country, and I had lived in the villages, my contact with Russian soldiers, our old contact with Russian soldiers and with Russian people, village people, mainly, because panzer divisions moved mainly around in the countryside, not so much in towns, was very close. We in winter, we always moved into the houses. We stayed with them, we ate with them, we slept with them. And I don't mean sleeping in a sexual way. We slept in the same house, in the same room, and most of the houses had only one room. One couldn't help it. We had a very warm feeling to them. They were kind people, and they helped us in so many ways. I remember I had the flu once, and a Russian woman, she came in with broth. I don't know whether I mentioned that story before. She more or less forced her way in because my mates didn't want to let her in. I was lying in a corner, and I felt so miserable. And she brought, every day then, she brought soup and looked after me, and she washed my face and asked me whether she was an old woman, whether I wanted a wash, a good wash. And she did everything for me. There's just one instance that we had respect building up for the Russian people.